Rory McLeod, full-length rain mac on and his striped pyjamas. Guys, you've just done your last show. Chris Evans takes over a week on Monday. Why on earth would you make a big deal out of a Snoop tape?
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Russ Williams.
I was born in Lytham St Annes, within an eight iron of the 16th tee, and I moved from Lytham St Annes and I went to Blackpool. I went to a school called Waterloo Road Junior School. I played for the school football team and did all the usual, you know, pushing and shoving in the playground. From there, after I took my 11 plus, and I was very fortunate, incidentally, my parents both worked and I was looked after by a lady in Blackpool called Edith Crawshaw, who I used to call Mrs. C. And she had a spastic daughter who's still with us called Judith, and they had a poodle, and they used to look after me while my parents were at work after school. I had some amazing times with them that kind of gave me the right sort of fabric as you move forward as a very young human being. And ironically, the neighbours were the Nolan family, who weren't famous. And I used to play doctors and nurses with Colleen Nolan, but I knew them all. Even at an early age, they were playing at sort of Butlins and what have you. From there, we moved away because of my father's job, and we went to Eastbourne. And then I went to Eastbourne Grammar School, where I had some of the best and some of the worst times of my life because I didn't really like school. And I remember my careers teacher saying to me, "Well then, Russell, what do you want to do when you get older?" I said, "I'm going to be on the radio." And he just laughed at me.
The Applejacks will tell me when. The boys and girls, who up until recently were students in Birmingham. Well, they've now made enough money to take over the school. I saw their schoolmistress the other day, and I wouldn't...
And I remember when I was very young in Blackpool, that was where I had my first awareness of the radio. And I used to listen to Pete Murray, I think, on the Light programme. And I used to be under the duvet with this knackered old transistor radio. I was captivated by the theatre of the mind of it all and what it would be like to be on the radio. And I became absolutely hooked. And I said to my dad at the time, "I'm going to be on the radio." So he said, "Yes, of course you are, son. Forget about that one."
Young Rascal there for you, and the number entitled "A Girl Like You." Coming up now to 17 minutes before 10 o'clock in the morning, you're listening to the Daffy Donahue Show from Radio Caroline North.
And I remember listening to Radio Caroline North, which is going back a bit, and I wasn't really that aware of radio when I moved to Eastbourne, aside from Brian Hayes on LBC. Used to get a dodgy old signal down there from 11:52 a.m. And I used to love Brian Hayes because I love this style.
You've actually got to lead. You're not there as a sponge. You've got to lead, and therefore you construct a programme.
And so that reignited that sort of programme, that speech radio of LBC. Radio 1 was king. If you loved music, it was the station of the stars. It was moving into its absolutely golden period. I remember when, you know, standing in the bus shelter on the way to the grammar school after a lunch break to go back to school, and I'd have my little transistor, I'd have the earpiece running up the inside of my jacket into my ear, and I would listen to the handover between Paul Burnett and Diddy David Hamilton, two gentlemen that I would get to know, unbelievably, it would have been to me at that time, later on in my radio career.
Paul Burnett on Radio 1.
Yeah, I bet you can't go 3 hours of your programme without mentioning the heatwave.
Bet you I can.
Bet you can't.
And in my world of dreams, this is who I wanted to be like. And Paul Burnett, to me, is still one of the great broadcasters I think this country's ever had in music and radio. And so I would take this to school with me. I'd sit in the lessons. I'd have, you know, rubbers thrown at me by teachers. "What are you doing?" "Oh, nothing, sir." And I'd be listening to the radio in the afternoon. And it was just a magical world that I wanted to be part of. I've always had a sixth sense, and I know it probably sounds a bit creepy, and it's not meant to be creepy. In all aspects of my life, I've had a sixth sense It's as if, not a voice in your head, but you've got a feeling you're going to do something. And I always knew, although I made plans when I left the grammar school, where I did particularly badly in my exams, and I had to go and basically study again at a college of further education. I did an HND in business studies and A-levels, and I got S-level and A-level economics. So I got a job, and incidentally, from the age of 11, I'd worked at the hospital radio in Eastbourne, first collecting, you know, requests, and then they go, well, we'll let you on the mic a little bit. And I ended up having two or three shows a week, and I pursued that absolutely implicitly over a period of about 7 or 8 years. But they always used to say, you sound older than you are. So we had some great times, and you know, you get your first girlfriend and all that kind of stuff. And I was massively interested in music. Whenever the road show was in town from Radio 1, I'd be down there, sort of standing there, gawping at it. In fact, I was there on the infamous occasion where Paul Burnett got stung in his throat by a wasp.
I have been stung by a wasp. Get this, I swallowed it, and it stung me on its way down, the naughty little...
While the records were playing, they were pouring ice cubes into his mouth to keep the swelling down, and he got through the show. That is a trooper. He comes from a circus family, Paul, as many people would know. So all these kind of things, this is a great fun thing to do, you know. But anyway, I went and got my first job, and I worked for NatWest Bank. I went into the Trust and Tax Services Department. Stayed there for best part of 3 years. They sent me up to the bank's headquarters in Oxfordshire, a place called Heythrop Park, and I was moving forward and doing rather well in the bank. And I would have been 21, and I was on a salary then of about 9,000 a year, which is a lot of money, 1% mortgage guaranteed for life, all the perks that you get with a bank. But it was dull. It was dull. Unlike the people I worked with, it wasn't what I wanted to do. And one day, I saw an advert for a new station in Brighton called Southern Sound, and they were advertising for like a production assistant, and there was an address there. I put together a demo tape, not on a cassette, on a reel-to-reel tape, and I did a news demo. I did reporting, news reading, and I thought, well, I'll give it a go, you know, maybe it's now or never, really. Amazingly, I got a letter back saying, really like what I heard, come and see me. And that was from Rory McLeod, former stalwart, of course, of LBC with Keith Belcher. And it emerged that him and his partner at the time, and still his partner, Barbara Groom of Radio 4, were blown away by this older sounding voice and couldn't quite believe the age of the person. Because obviously you send in, you know, some form of CV. And I went over to see them, and I got a job basically as a dog's body. And they said, your salary is £2,250 a year. So I went home and I spoke to my mum and dad, and I said to my dad, I've got a chance to get into radio. And bless him, my dad, he wasn't convinced at all. From Eastbourne to Brighton, Portslade, where they were, their offices were in Brighton before the Portslade bakery was converted for the studios. So I went over there and I met him, and he said, look, we want to send you to the National Broadcasting School in Greek Street, which was run by... dear old Michael Bucht, fabulous man.
I mean, with places like Capital making more money than a horse has hair, right? It was sloshing about in the IBA's coffers. So they decided to set up a national broadcasting school, and it was for 6 years until the IBA itself was changed.
And he was the principal, and they paid for it, but I had to find accommodation in London to stay in. Fortunately, good old Gran took me in for 3 months. That's when I became acquainted absolutely with Capital Radio, and I particularly remember after long days, John Sachs in the evening, another one of my favourite broadcasters.
How many needles would you use to crochet?
One.
What colour are rubies?
Red.
In politics, what do the letters MP stand for? In the saying, what does every clown
I did 3 months there, but I did the journalism course and the music programming course, and Jeremy Vine was on my course. And Jeremy, he said to me, oh, God, you're going to walk into this business. You've got a job already. I've got to get a job, you know, blah, blah. And we all know what happened to Jeremy. And he was plying his trade when he wasn't at the broadcasting school in a band. He was a bit of a frustrated pop star, this sort of gangly boy called the Flared Generation. And so we became pretty friendly, and Jeremy always kept in touch, and we still keep in touch. But the head of the programming department was Neil Spence, who had been an old pirate jock He's no longer with us, but I tell you what, he is one of the men that I am totally privileged to have come into contact with.
Mr. Tambourine Man, there, 19 on the charts, and you got 6 minutes before the TW show at 3 o'clock.
And to have him as a mentor, as my course tutor, despite all his bizarre ways. I mean, he used to get the train down from Nottingham every day, or no, Grantham. He was a bloody train from Grantham, sodding late again, bloody useless. I mean, that's exactly what Neil was like. But when we sat down and talked about the art of radio and what is expected of people, everything he said, one-to-one, you know, sound confident, think about your links, all the stuff that all broadcasters are told, he really meant it. He drilled it into me at the age of 21. We did demo radio shows that were piped round the building and what have you. Michael Buck would sit there with his arms behind his neck like this, slapping his hands like he used to do when he spoke, and he'd say, come up and see me, Fred. Now, your show, I listen to it, blah, blah, blah. And he'd say, Russ, your show, blah, 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 really good, but work on this. These were unbelievable people. Michael Buck had been the programme director of Capital Radio. And Michael Bucht was a great inspiration as well. And I always thought, despite him being, in inverted commas, a fan of mine while I was at the MBS, if I'd have sent him a demo tape, I probably wouldn't have got a job if he was in charge of Capital. But it was of its time, and I think it's a tremendous shame that the industry does not have a school like the National Broadcasting School, and it closed down. It was all down to money and finances. And you could go there, you could apply, but if you had the money, you would get in, which is fine for them, but maybe it's not so good for the industry. I was on the course with people who, well, they shouldn't have been allowed to own a radio, let alone be on one. After I left the National Broadcasting School, off I trundled to Port Slade. And Southern Sound was based in Port Slade, Franklin Road. I got down there and managed to get some digs sorted out with a lovely couple called Reg and Gina. But Andy Stegall lived there, Paul Woodley, who was head of news, and me. And we put in so much hard work on dry runs and getting everything done. I was basically at the beck and call of everybody. Russ, can you do this? I might have got a little dry run on the gear. The gear was installed. It was probably the best radio desk I've ever worked with. Maldwyn Bowden International. There was Mel Bowden and Michael Fabricant, MP. He of the hair. And so we did all the stuff that you do building up to the launch of a radio station. And then we went on the air August 1983, and we were up and running, and Rory McLeod was the boss, Keith Belcher was the big boss, two amazing men who I love to death to this day, and he was a brilliant teacher.
Don't forget, Southern Sound will be going on the air at 7:45 on Bank Holiday Monday, the 29th of August 1983. Tune into Southern Sound and join the family.
One of the first things Rory said to me, he said, right, cock, everyone was cock. He said, now listen to me, cock. He said, one thing you're going to learn, and learn very quickly, is the world is full of wankers. And I thought, oh, that's a bit harsh. I'm uncomfortable about hearing that language come from, you know, being slightly naive, having come from a bank, you know, to dealing with somebody from the heady room of LBC, you know, and all the shenanigans that went on there, who was now my boss. But I knew what he meant as I got older, because you do meet an awful lot of people in all walks of life who may not be as he described it, but they certainly let you down or surprise you by some of the ridiculous things that they do. So I think what he was trying to say was, you know, this is the beginning of a journey, I hope, for you, but just watch out. And I have to say, personally, I haven't met many, if any at all. I actually haven't. I've genuinely got on with everyone. Southern Sound, as I mentioned, was a converted bakery, and you'd walk in the reception, there would be two security doors, push them, and you would go into the newsroom. if you came back out, the reception was there. Go round to the left of reception, there's a big glass window, the main on air, another security door, a couple of offices, engineering, and the second studio, and almost a sound studio for live music or debates or whatever you wanted to do. You've got to bear in mind, Rory and Keith were news-based. They wanted to fulfil part of their obligation and agreement to get a licence in Brighton to have politics shows. So that was it. Out the back was a car park that kept the radio truck with the Sunshine logo on it, and upstairs were the offices, and I'm pretty sure it was haunted. A lot of people got very spooked up there, and because my one show a week, in fact I did two shows, apart from being in the week, the Dog's Body, the Man Friday, as Rory used to call me, I was given the Saturday and Sunday morning breakfast shows, and there was nothing on the transmitter, of course. I had to go in and switch the transmitter on, which on the first occasion, when I did my first show, I was pretty nervous about, but I managed to do it, and I had to go upstairs and turn off the alarm and everything. And I always got this cold feeling in this one area of the building, and I thought, well, that's a bit weird. And then I kept hearing stories about stuff moving and what have you. Who knows? And I remember my first show, 6:30 in the morning it was. I was 200 yards down the road in my digs, got in, you know, like to get in early, do all my prep, the alarm switched off, get the running order that was printed out for me. And the first record I ever played on commercial radio was at Southern Sound, Dinah Ross, Touch Me in the Morning. So he's got a very special part in my radio career and in my heart, because that was what started it all.
Touch me.
My father accepted that I was going to work in the radio. He didn't think it was a good idea that I'd left the bank. But I had some amazing times at Southern Sound, covering train strikes and doing all the shows on the schedule. I eventually, within about 6 months to a year, was doing the mid-morning show, half of it a music show, the second half of it a current affairs phone-in from local politicians, people like Geoffrey Archer, Norman Tebbit, because of course, Tory party conferences or political conferences were down there. I'd have a medium in occasionally. It was a different ball game in those days. You had to stick to the rules, but they were very specific, and people would phone in and give their opinion on chosen topics and what have you. And that was my first taste of speech radio.
The bomb attack on the Grand Hotel early this morning was first and foremost an inhuman, undiscriminating attempt to massacre innocent, unsuspecting men and women staying in Brighton.
When I was at Southern, of course, the conference. Brighton bomb, I think it was 1984, October. So I'd been there just about a year, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, Gina of Gina and Reg, who I was lodging with, came up to my bedroom and, sort of, Ross, somebody's here for you. So I went down the stairs dishevelled, and standing there in front of me, I mean, quite a sight really, Rory MacLeod with his pink baldish head, full-length rain mac on, and his striped pyjamas and leather slippers. And he said to me, hello, cock, they've tried to blow up the Grand Hotel. Get your shoes, you're going on the air. So I was 21 years old. I thought, blimey. Right, so Rory, he's on the news desk, all the journalists are coming in. And I did the breakfast show on Southern Sound in Brighton the morning after the bomb, the night before. And I remember it. I played two records in 4 hours. I was linking to reporters, news updates with the newsroom, updating people as they woke up. I mean, this was think on your feet radio, terrifying as it was, because the sense of responsibility you have as a broadcaster, and I've been on the air on many radio stations for pretty much every good thing that's happened in the last 35 years, but also the bad things when you have to tell people about wars and terrorist attacks and what have you. So this was, I think, an absolutely wonderful thing in many ways that happened to me as a broadcaster, because you go from kind of being a jovial kid to actually having to have some gravitas, and I learnt that very, very quickly. Well, out of the blue, one day, my phone rang. I think it was in my office at Southern. It sounds very grand. I shared an office with John Mann, another one of my very good friend, broadcaster. And I was in there on my own, and the phone went.
because they didn't have mobile phones, you see, in those days. And there was a voice at the end. He said, "Hello, Russ. I'm Charles Squire here. I've been sitting on the end of the pier listening to you. And I'd like to see you. Would you be prepared to come up to Newcastle to talk to Mick Johnson?" It was his boss. And I said, "Well, it's very, very nice to hear from you." He said, "Look, I'll write you a letter. We'll fly you up from Gatwick, Dan Air." And so they did. So undercover, I went up there. I thought, I've got a seafront flat in Brighton, albeit a small one. I look out of my window and I see the sea. I've got a circle of friends. I've got a great job on the radio. Why on earth would I want to go to Newcastle? Why? Don't be mad. Anyway, because I'm an open-minded person, I thought, well, I'll go. So I went up there. They rolled out the coal-coloured carpet for me in Swalwell. And I went to see them. Giles was absolutely brilliant and inspirational. He said, I want you to come and do the afternoon show. I met Mick Johnson, who was the big programme director. He was not quite as ebullient, if you like, as Giles, but very businesslike, very complimentary. Wrote down on a bit of paper, he said, "If we paid you that, would that be enough to make you come?" And I looked at the figure, and it was considerably more than I was getting at Brighton. So I undertook to phone Giles. I had to think about it. And something told me that it was going to be a good thing to do. And I went to see Rory, and I said, "Look, Rory, I'm really grateful that you gave me my chance, but I've been offered this job and I feel that it's a good thing for me to do." And he was brilliant about it. He said, "Well, I don't want to lose you." And they came up with a counter offer that was still below what Metro offered me. And I said, "You know what?" I said, I think I've had my head turned a little bit, because it was quite an impressive, much bigger operation, a metropolitan city, hugely successful radio station. I wanted to be part of that. I saw it as the next progression in my career. Metro. I arrived in Newcastle. I had sourced somehow one bedroom in a house in an area called Jesmond. And my new flatmates were so wonderful. I didn't drive. They said, we'll give you a lift over there. But there's a nice pub in Gateshead that overlooks the Tyne. And we can go and have a drink there. And I think I was on the northeast night shift, made famous by a guy called Dave Bray many years ago. So we went for a drink and they dropped me off and they became the greatest flatmates I ever had. And I completely immersed myself in the Northeast. And there was a great roster of people up there. Alan Robson, of course, who's still there, a radio legend. Steve Coleman was doing the breakfast show. Nicky Brown was doing the evening show. There was Mark Forrest was there as a kind of junior. Jimmy Savile turned up after about 18 months doing Savile's Travels. Giles had got him in. They were a very, very progressive company. They were aggressive. They wanted to be the best, and I really liked that. And Steve Martin was the senior producer, and he ran it. And the senior presenter was a bloke called Mark Goodyear, who, of course, we all know. And I became very friendly with Mark because he lived in Gosforth. I lived in Jesmond. He lived with Jacqueline, his wife, and they had a wonderful dog called Farron, named after a Prefab Sprout song.
Antics.
Mark was the senior presenter, and his job was to sit down with the jocks and go through an air check cassette. Some companies, of course, call them Snoop tapes. Now, air check's better. Snoop is spying. It's a negative word. Why on earth would you make a big deal out of a Snoop tape? Anyway, we did the air checks. I think I did one with him, and he said, "Just carry on doing what you're doing, love." And within about 6 months, he'd gone to Radio 1, and Giles came to me. He said, "Mark's gone. Will you be my senior presenter?" I'm a great bloke, Giles. And so I became senior presenter. And I have to be honest, I felt comfortable about saying I would have done that perhaps a little differently. But I didn't really want to get into the sort of the bollocking side of things, because I think it's negative. I think if somebody's not doing something right, you can speak to them in a certain way and reason with their better nature and maybe appeal to them to think about doing it in a different way without actually rocking the boat too much. Of course, sometimes somebody's going to swear on air or something like that, or something's going to happen, which is a much more serious thing. But the idea of sitting down with people every other week or every week doing air checks, to me, it's a personal opinion. It's a negative thing. You know, as a broadcaster, whether you're doing good shows or not. And your boss, sure as heck, should be telling you I mean, it's just an exercise of power over somebody, and I think it's entirely negative, and I didn't want to do it.
Hello, good afternoon. No Steve King this afternoon. Instead, it's Metro's new boy. My name is Russ Williams, and what a way to start.
I had such a wonderful, wonderful time professionally and personally growing up in my mid-20s. I think I left there when I was about 30. And I'm so glad Giles phoned me and I had the bottle to go up there, or the foresight to do it. Sounded unbelievable. They had a wonderful jingle package. The music was fantastically put together. For quite a period of time, if not most of it, was bigger than Radio 1's. The people of the northeast of England, Metro was their station, and they tapped into that local market like you wouldn't believe, with the slickness and entertainment of Radio 1. Giles had a plan and Giles executed it brilliantly, and they all went on to make quite a bit of money when they sold it on, and they deserved every penny of it, and you know, it was of its time.
I want to dance with somebody who loves me from Whitney Houston. Music from Katrina and the Waves coming up next, and also news about our Big Bowie special.
So my time at Metro was entirely happy, and whilst I was there, Kid Jensen used to come up and do his show for Capital because he was hosting the Roxy at Tyne Tees Television.
First on Roxy, that's Tip at number 14, and could it be?
And I got friendly with Kid because Jim Brown, the late great production genius that was Jim Brown, was charged with looking after Kid and ended up producing his show for Capital down the line. So he said, come and meet Dave. And so I went down there and he said, I think you should be in London. I said, well, that'd be nice. I said, Mark's gone, Mark Goodyear. I said, I've done 3 or 4 years up here. It might be the time to go. He said, let me have a word with Richard Park. Mark Goodyear was down on Radio 1. I kept in contact with Mark and he said, I keep seeing Richard and I keep mentioning you, and he knows all about you and he thinks you're good. And one day, out of the blue, the phone went. He went, hello, Russ, Richard Park here. How are you? How would you like to come play with the big boys? He says, wind up. He said, it's Richard Park here, Russ, from Capital. I'm a big admirer of yours. Can you come down and see me? Surreptitiously, nipped down on the train and went out for lunch with him along the Euston Road. Took my wife, and we sat down, we had lunch, and at the end of it, he said, well, it's been great to see you, can't wait for you to start at Capital. We're all looking forward to seeing you anyway, I've got to go. And then he tapped his suit pocket, he went, I appear to be financially embarrassed. So I ended up paying for the lunch. And so I thought, oh, right, okay. And apparently he's done that quite a bit over the years. I don't know, but he did it with me. And so I picked up the tab, and quite right, he was probably thinking, I'm giving you a bloody chance, you can pay. I ended up moving down to London, and I remember the drive down, listening to Steve Wright in the afternoon on BBC Radio 1. And it was the afternoon that Elton John and Sacrifice, it just gone to number one, and Elton John came in the studio, and I remember listening to that interview and thinking, wow, this is big boys radio, isn't it? You know, I felt it was up a notch from even Metro, you know.
It's a human sign when things go wrong.
And then I tuned into Capital and it was all when Pat and Mick and Tarrant on the breakfast show, and I mean it was untouchable in London. The job that Richard did with it was phenomenal. And they had a vision, and Richard could pick a hit record, and they were unstoppable. And I made my debut one Saturday morning, and the phone went, the red light, about 10:05. He said, it's Richard Park for you. I thought, oh, God, because I'd heard, you know, that he can be a bit feisty, which he is sometimes, but usually when you deserve it. I picked up the phone, hello, Richard, how are you? He said, how do you think it went? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, and bear in mind, it's the summer. It's not the football season, so there was no football analogy. He said, I would say 4 runs. Not 6, but 4. And that was it. So I was at Capital then. He was brilliant to me. And I did pretty much every show on the schedule. In fact, in my last year at Capital, working at the Euston Tower, I did the best part of 4 months in the Inver Tarrant on the breakfast show. I was his cover. That was fantastic exposure for me as a broadcaster. He was very, very supportive. Richard, he wouldn't have put me on it otherwise. And but Chris was Chris. I mean, you know, a legend. And I had some wonderful times at Capital. I mean, to walk up those stairs at the Euston Tower and think, my God, I'm going to do a show in here.
and to be there and be part of it.
From the center of the city, 95.8, Capital FM.
Jonathan Pierce is there, and I've met Jonathan incidentally. He was a sports editor at Southern Sound in Brighton. And Jonathan used to like a few sherbets back in the day, far more clean living now, of course. I do remember one day, well, I think he'd been down to the pub in Port Slade, and I was on breakfast and he was doing the sports news, and he'd overslept, and he lived in a caravan in the car park of Southern. And I had to knock on the door. I said, "Jonathan, you're on in 5 minutes." And he bleary-eyed, "Oh, okay, mate, I'm coming." And he'd look terrible. But as soon as the mic opened, "Yeah, Brighton and Hove Albion, this, that and the other." And then he'd go, you know, throw up in the toilets or so. Amazing times. Jonathan got me involved fairly loosely on Capital Gold Sport. Steve Wilson was there, Rob Watton, just a brilliant, brilliant team of people. And so I flirted with a bit of sport, but music was where it was at for me. And the station buzzed. It was the efficient music machine, the money-making machine. And it made money because it was blinking good at what it did, and it served what Londoners wanted.
Great music for a great...
Russ Williams, Capital FM.
Well, good morning. Pretty foggy, I'm afraid, at the moment. 8 degrees, 46 Fahrenheit, the high this afternoon.
In those days, you were lucky if you got a fax. But it was all on the phone, wasn't it? The competitions, people would phone in. There was no internet at that time. I left Capital in 93. There was an embryonic internet, I think, but nothing that was used at the station. And when I arrived at Capital, I was put in an office and then I was moved. I don't know why, but I ended up sharing with Kenny Everett and Richard Allinson. Richard's a great professional broadcaster, get on with Richard very well. But Kenny was Kenny. Kenny used to have the beginning of his show whenever he went out for an Indian lunch on a cart, one of these big NAB carts. And he'd be in the Lal Keela Indian restaurant on Tottenham Court Road. And even the waiter would say, Mr. Kenny, 10 minutes, you're on the air. And he would walk up the stairs and then he would sit down in the Capital Gold studio, put in the cartridge, which he'd recorded at home, and the news would finish. And he'd just press it and it'd be the first 5-10 minutes of his show. He was absolutely extraordinary. He was very funny.
And now... Commercial Radio, the service with the biggest tits in Britain, brings you Hello Time.
Hello, 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 hello.
I never spoke to Kenny about radio, really, because I would have felt a bit like an anorak. General conversation with Kenny and talk about life, and he told me a great story about Freddie Mercury and Roger Taylor turning up at his house in Kensington. And they'd recorded a song and they wanted Kenny to listen to it. And Kenny said, "Hello, darlings, come on in, give me the tape." And he put it on and they were standing in the corner there looking rather nervous. He pressed the tape and it played the song and he stopped it. I looked at them both and said, "It's effing number one, darlings." And the record company were very nervous that something that was 5 minutes, 40-odd seconds long was just too long for airplay on the radio. And Kenny was very much part of that. And he was too modest to actually say it, but I subsequently found out of pushing them to push for that to come out. And, of course, it was one of the great moments of rock history. During my radio career, 35 years, I applied for one job, and that was at Southern. Every other job I've been so lucky, the phone has gone. And I first came into contact with Virgin Radio when the brains behind it were Andrew Marshall and John Amonier. Andrew Marshall I knew from my days at Southern, and they were working out of an office at TVAM. There was rumours that this station was going to start and that Branson wanted to do it and it was definitely going to happen. A licence had been granted, blah, 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 blah. Andrew Marshall got in touch and I tramped over to TVAM and he said, "Oh, I think you'd be quite good for it. You know, I'm interested in you." He was going to be the programme director. Amonier was going to be the CEO or whatever you want to call it. Then they were removed from the project for reasons that are probably too boring to go into. And actually, if I'm truthful, I don't know. I can't remember the reasons why. And Richard Branson asked his brother-in-law, Robert Devereux,
to sort out somebody else to run it. And that man was David Campbell. And David Campbell had somehow seconded John Revel to become part of it. And Richard Skinner was part of it, of course. They were the first joint programme directors. I got a phone call one night at my house in Highgate. I would say about a month, 6 weeks after I'd met Andrew Marshall and John Amonier. And he just phoned me. He said, "Hello, Russ, it's John Revel here. We were talking to you," and started laughing. He said, "Because John and Andrew have gone and now there's a different team in running it. Obviously, I'm aware of your work on Capital and listen to you. Would you like to come and see David Campbell, myself and Richard Skinner for a chat?" So off I trotted to a meeting at Rush's, which was Virgin's post-production facility in Soho. John wasn't there, but Richard Skinner and David Campbell were. And I went all the way up the stairs to the top. There's big Dave Campbell sitting behind the desk. "Oh, nice to meet you. Richard's going to nice to meet you." They said, "Well, you know, it's going to be exciting. And, you know, Branson's right behind this. And I know you're at Capital. We love what you're doing. Chris Evans is going to be involved. And Tommy Vance is on board. We would like you to come and join us to do 1 to 4 in the afternoon." And I thought, "Oh, that's good. No getting up early. National radio, albeit only on medium wave." I said, "Well, look, I appreciate it. Can I have a few days to think about it and let you know?" Grapevine had got into full overload, and news had reached the Euston Tower. And there was a conversation between Michael Cohen, who's still my manager now, and Richard Park. And Michael said, "Look, they do want him to go, but no decision has been made yet." And, of course, that didn't go down very well. And got a phone call from Richard's PA, and she said, "I got Richard for you." And Richard phoned me up. He said, "Look, it's entirely obvious to me that you're going." He said, "I cannot tell you how upset I am about this. You are a traitor." Words to that effect. And I said, "What, like you were when you left Radio Clyde to go to Capital?" Silence on the end of the phone. He said, "Well, you are going. I know you're leaving and you won't be coming back, and we'll settle your contract." And I went on extended gardening leave, and he was absolutely furious with me, which I kind of understood. But I had that sixth sense again that this is worth a go. Big risks. Leave Capital, don't get invited back. No, no, no. Once you leave the golf club, the invite doesn't come again. So I took a chance and I went there. Was paid more money, but it was the platform and the excitement of being involved with Virgin, you know, that really appealed to me. Of course, money for anybody in any job is important, but I think you have to be realistic. It's not the be-all and end-all. So I did join, and I spent about 6 weeks gardening leave in the Caribbean. Much more music. It was a building site. Golden Square was a building site when I went in there. And there were studios half built and what have you. And is everything going to be finished before, you know, we want to even do some test broadcasts? Sure enough, it got done. And the team slowly but surely was being lined up. Nick Abbott, Tommy Vance, another one who's no longer with us, amazing man. A guy called Mitch Johnson was demoing for The Breakfast Show. Mitch was on board. And Jonathan Coleman was coming in to do something in the evening. Kevin Greening was subsequently on in the afternoon, no longer with us as well. Lovely, lovely man and a fantastic broadcaster. There was a fair dollop of BBC London in there. Evans was going to do the Big Red Mug Show at the weekends. It was sponsored by Nescafe. And it was all starting to come together. And one afternoon I got a phone call from John Revel. He said, "Hello, Russ. John here. How are you doing, mate?" I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." He said, "Have you got two alarm clocks?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you're going to need them because I want you to do breakfast." Tommy Vance used to sneak with a few of them on late at night to do illegal test transmissions. And, you know, it was all very naughty. It was Branson-esque. It was pushing the boundaries. And they called it the Radio Revolution.
1 minute and counting to the Radio Revolution.
On the first day, Richard Skinner did the first show, aided and abetted by a few of the other staff. The night before, I flew with David Campbell all the way to Edinburgh in a helicopter from Elstree. And we took a little detour. The pilot said, "Do you want to go and see some waterfalls in the Lake District?" Well, we're here. We went, "Oh, go on then." So we did that and we landed, and Richard Branson was at the Virgin Hotel in Edinburgh, and then Richard, David Campbell, John Pearson, the head of sales at the time, later to become chief executive. We all went with some other guys from the sales department to sit down with some advertisers from that neck of the woods, had dinner with them, and the following day, Virgin was launching at 12:15. So I got up in the morning, such great excitement. David Campbell, Richard Branson and myself, flight from Edinburgh to Newcastle. We went to the Virgin Megastore there, rah, 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 press. It's going to be, don't forget to listen, everyone, at 12:15. And then we scooted across to Liverpool, Richard and Judy show at the Albert Dock, rah, rah, rah. You know, very exciting. I mean, unbelievable. Zigzag the whole country in a day.
5 seconds and counting to the official launch of Virgin 12:15.
We ended up in Manchester with Midgeur performing live at the Virgin Megastore in Manchester. And the picture of Richard actually pressing the button to go on the air, you will see me holding up his arm.
Hello to everyone here in Manchester and across the UK. It's 12:15 on Friday, April 30th, 1993. A date which will go down, we hope, in broadcasting history.
So a great moment in history and a pleasure to be there with him because it was great fun.
Well, good afternoon. This is Richard.
And so we were on the air and then the hard work actually had to start. But it was tremendous fun. It was fun. That was a great thing about Virgin. It was edgy. It was fun. Negatives were treated as positives, even though they were actually negatives. There was ways around everything. Nothing could be an obstacle to Virgin Radio. Richard was tremendously excited about having a radio station. I mean, we all know that he started his record company from a phone box.
I'm Richard Branson, and this is the radio station I've always wanted to hear.
His track record in the music industry was amazing, and he is a music fan, and I think for him it was a very natural extension of all the other Virgin brands. But he was passionate about Virgin Radio, was quite heavily involved in the early days, would come in an awful lot. Robert Devereux, his brother-in-law, was his eyes and ears, and David Campbell spent a lot of time with Richard. Richard would phone up and say, I don't know the music we're playing there. I don't think that person is really quite good enough for us. You know, there would be those conversations, I understand. At the end of the day, it all comes down to numbers and revenue. I remember my first serious meeting with David Campbell after launch, when he sat down, he said, well, we've got the figures in. He said, they're all right. He said, but look, we are being battered. And he was raging. He said, we are being battered by a bunch of kids in a field in Ireland, which was Atlantic 252. And he said, we can't continue with radio station ratings like this. You've got to get them up, starting at breakfast. And I said, I agree, but we're very, very young. Slowly, slowly, catchy monkey. But there was no appetite for slowness with David. Things had to change pretty quickly. I said to John, doing a breakfast show on your own, it is really hard, not having anyone to bounce off. Every big breakfast show you can think of in radio, apart from Terry Wogan, they've got one or more people bouncing off the perceived main host. He said, yeah, I think we've got to do something about it. He said, how would you feel about working with Jono? I said, yeah. Jono and I started the breakfast show, and we did it for the best part of 6 years together. And they were truly the next level amazing times.
Brand new music from Dodgy, good enough for us. Jono here, dial a watt here in 1 hour. And if your telephone rings, pick up your phone and say yes.
When we started the Russ and Jono show, it was quite funny because people were saying, oh, they quite clearly don't like each other, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Absolute rubbish. We got on really well from day one. Jono is a certain type of character, I'm a certain type of character, but that entire show, everything we did on the air, from features to gags to everything, was 50-50. We all, both of us came up with stuff, and the show started to grow, the figures started to go up. I remember David Campbell sending me a clip from Private Eye, faxing it to me at home and saying, Russell, Jono must be famous now, they're talking about you in Private Eye, which was a kind of compliment. But we went from strength to strength. And what made us unusual, I think, apart from the obvious thing, Australian and a Brit, we were two blokes. As the show went forward, we were right up there, if not slightly ahead, albeit nationally, with Chris Tarrant. But of course, it's very easy to say that we did that without any help at all. Well, that wouldn't be true, because the help came in the form of 105.8 FM in London. Because I think Virgin Radio probably not even been a success if it was now. But at the time, to get an FM license in London, no digital radio, obviously, and be medium wave around the whole of the UK, the management and Branson knew that that FM window into the world of Virgin would get a lot more listeners. I mean, there was a real war going on, a radio war, with hardly any participants at the time, not like it is now. We had to keep the show fresh, we had to keep coming up with ideas, we had regular features like Shankar and Edward, the newsreaders, thank you very much indeed. We had Russ and Jono's instant request line, which was just one of the most bizarre things ever, that we'd say, phone us up if you want to hear a record, you say it, we play it, and so we get, hello, Russ and Jono, John here, morning Dave, and then he'd go, what do you want to hear? He said, I'd love to hear David Bowie, Let's Dance, you say it, we play it, here's Madonna, you know, just taking the mickey out of local radio. We did the show in the last 6 to 9 months of doing it in front of a live audience every day. So we'd have nurses filling up the audience one day, musicians, taxi drivers, the cast of The Bill one day. People came in, and you wouldn't have Diana Ross we interviewed. You know, Diana Ross, you know, the whole gambit, and wanted to be part of the show. Piers Morgan, for about a year, was our showbiz reporter. When you're lucky enough to be involved with all these people. And we went from strength to strength.
Remember, it's all in Australian dollars.
Australian dollars, of course, one of the most
very rich,
revered currencies around the world.
I don't want to upset him, but I think fame was more important for Jono than for me. Jono is a very ebullient character, famous in Australia, done a bit of television in the UK. He would go to the opening of an envelope, everything. And that's great, because he could talk about it on the show. I used to go to some. A memorable one was when we went to Legends of the Fall, the Anthony Hopkins movie, and Brad Pitt was in that film. And we were in the lineup to meet Prince Charles, and we were introduced to Brad Pitt by the PR ladies, you know, hanging around those sort of things. She said, Russ and John have come over here. And as I approached Brad Pitt, he held out his arm and he said, hi, I'm Brad. I said, I know you are. That's the measure of the guy that he thought we may not know who he was. And standing behind him was Gwyneth Paltrow, who was ever so sweet. She was his girlfriend at the time. But he was great fun. We did all the television stuff together. I was working at Sky Sports doing television, Soccer AM, and then I moved on to live football. Jono was doing his reporting on London Tonight. He was doing shows for VH1. He was much more showbiz and is really, really comfortable in that environment. Oh, I love you, darling, come on the show. And it was absolutely brilliant for the show.
What's for breakfast?
Virgin Radio was rumoured for quite a while to be in the thoughts of Richard Branson and the powers that be of Virgin Management. Maybe they were going to offload it if there was a buyer. Well, the buyer turned up in the shape of Capital Radio. And I thought, this could be tricky. So they called a staff meeting at 7:30 in the morning. We segued a couple of songs together and went out, and it was very, very somber. David Campbell said that we have agreed to sell Virgin Radio to Capital Radio. I was in the Caribbean for a holiday, and Richard Park was out there with his now wife Anna, and he was staying about 2 or 3 miles down the coast from me. So I phoned him up. We ended up meeting for dinner, and it was kind of like we put a line underneath, because he was really angry with me that I left Capital. He was hurt, there's no doubt about it, and I get that from his point of view. And we had dinner, beautiful restaurant, starlit night. Had a great time, shook hands, and he said, we'd just moved into Leicester Square, come and see me and we'll grab a bit of lunch in the Capital Cafe and I'll show you around. Now, of course, that's building bridges, and I thought that was nice, but also to have me floating around Capital is quite handy as well when the jocks are on there looking out, oh my God, look who's showing him around. So I'm sure there was an element of that. But I went to see Richard, he showed me around the Leicester Square building. He said, well, as you know, we're buying Virgin. He said, the good news is for you that you'll be staying. The bad news is for your colleagues that none of them will. So I left that lunch with a bit of a burden, because the deal hadn't actually gone through. I was in that kind of scenario, and that included the bloke I was working with. And that's really hard when you're close to somebody. Do you tell them or do you not tell them? I got lucky and called it right, because I did think maybe it won't go through. But they had a definitive plan, Capital Radio, for Virgin, and it wouldn't have been anything like Virgin Radio was, I'm sure, because they do things in a certain way, or they did. Anyway, it fell through, and everyone was pretty happy, and John and I continued on the breakfast show in front of our live audience every morning. That was actually really quite hard work. And I remember we just had the cast of The Bill in, and we wrapped up the show, and John Pearson, who was the then chief executive, because Virgin Radio was, people left and got paid off, and I think John Pearson actually got paid up about three times, and so he should, because he did a magnificent job at difficult times. But David was still around, but John was kind of like operations manager, and he said, can you come up and see me in the office? And he said, well, guys, you've just done your last show. Chris Evans takes over a week on Monday. So sharp intake of breath. Jono was not happy. I was slightly more pragmatic about it, given that Evans was the biggest media star in the country at the moment. He left Radio 1, of course, over the Friday incident, and he was at a loose end. And we moved to drive time, 4 to 7. We did that for 3 months. We had different contract lengths, Jono and I. Mine was 6 months longer, and he would go off to Australia at Christmas for a month. I used to get so bored, because I used to have to take a month as well. And I didn't want to sit on a beach for a month, really. And so I came back, and the programme director at the time was a guy called Jeff Holland, supported by Ian Grace. I mean, I've worked with some brilliant, brilliant programme directors there, all brilliant in their own different ways. But Jeff Holland said to me, he said, I've got some news for you, mate. Jono's not coming back. I went, why? He said, well, his contract's over and Chris is not renewing. Oh, dear. What's going to happen to me? He said, well, you've got 6 months to go, mate. We'll pay it off if you want, but we'd love you to stay. Can you go on to mid-mornings after Chris? So I spoke to Jono, and he was upset. He was. We went through a very difficult time in our relationship there, because I think he felt I should have walked away, and I felt I was contractually obligated, and I don't want to sit around doing nothing, being paid for 6 months, just not in my modus operandi. So I stayed, went on to mid-mornings, and ha-ha, stayed there for about 17 years. Jono ended up at Heart doing the breakfast show. He did ever so well there, and we repaired our relationship. Oh, clearly, it's not on the level it was, because he lives thousands of miles away, but we email, you know, I'm friendly with his family. We see each other when he comes over to the UK. So he left, I carried on, and Chris Evans bought the station. And that was a time of great excitement. It was a time, certainly, where the column inches were absolutely crazy. And I remember Chris, during that period, being not only extremely enthusiastic and positive about it, but also being dog-tired.
I used to come in to do the show, and there'd be boxes of new computers in the hallway. And because I owned the station, I'd be thinking, do we really need those?
And I remember he came in one day, and he said, I've been up all night. I've been in the City of London with my accountant, a guy called Kirit, who's a great guy. And he said, all I've done is just sign form after form after form. He said, I'm absolutely exhausted. I'm also terrified, Russ, he said, because I bought it. And so he ran the radio station, essentially, then. Not that the management would ever admit it, but, I mean, it was highs, highs, highs all the way for a while. He won't. I don't think he'd mind me saying this. He is a fantastically positive guy, but also can be a bit touchy and miserable and angry sometimes. He had a lot on the line, as it turned out for him. When he bought it and sold it financially, he did very, very well. But to risk pretty much all you've got and to be given the chance by Richard Branson to come up with a package to buy it, I thought was absolutely amazing. And I think he should be given enormous credit still for doing that. You know, broadcaster buys radio station. I mean, it was sensational news.
Okay, but what kind of pet funerals have you had on?
I remember he ran a competition to give away £1 million. And people thought, what's the catch? Ended up being won by a lady from Worthing, and there was her and a chap in the studio, and I was there watching these two battle it out for £1 million. And it was the most fantastic piece of radio you could ever listen to, let alone witness and listen to, which I was lucky enough to do. The lady won, and she was shaking, and her husband was there, and she, you know, she won £1 million, and it was at, what, 2001. The guy was quite crestfallen. He got so close and yet so far, and it was all about, yes, you won the money, and that's it from us. We said we'd do it, you know. Talk to you on Monday or whatever, and Russie's up next, da-da-dum. And I saw Chris wander up the corridor about 5 minutes after the show, and the guy who'd lost £1 million was sitting there with a cup of coffee and people going, oh, never mind, mate. And I saw him carrying something, and I handed it to him. And I thought, oh, I wonder what that was. And it turned out that Chris wrote him a cheque for £100,000 of his own money and gave it to him. And I think that tells you a lot more about Chris Evans and the stuff you can read and hear about him, because he was an incredibly generous person and had very, very high standards and demanded the standards that he achieved of everyone around him. Obviously, given his talent and ability, for the vast majority of people, that is not easy to even get near. And I think sometimes he got frustrated with that. Virgin Radio. S&P and Promotions, they were the kings. They punched above their weight. This was a radio station that in its heyday made 20-odd million pounds profit a year. A year.
I can confirm on behalf of Virgin Radio that Chris Evans is no longer a presenter at the station. He has been in breach of his contract, and we were left with no option but to terminate it.
I was there on the day of the last show that Chris Evans did. There had been a lot of fractious activity between the new owners after Chris sold it, Scottish Media Group, who, Andrew Flanagan and the boys from Scotland, I found them to be absolutely amazing. You know, there were certain things with the programme director team at the time. There was Bobby Hain for a while, and then Paul Jackson came in, who, in my opinion, was utterly brilliant for Virgin Radio, and to me personally was a fantastic human being when I had a very difficult time in my life. But as time went by, after Chris sold it, relations became more and more strained for reasons that I can't even begin to speculate on, because I don't know the full story. It'd be wrong to do so, but you could see it deteriorating. There was one day when Chris wanted to do something on the air. The management were not keen, and I think it was Bobby Hain. Bobby was out of the building, but he'd phoned one of the middle management guys, say, please, can you go up and say, Chris, this is not a good idea. We do not want him to do it. And the door opened. I felt sorry for this guy. I was getting ready to take over, and the record was playing, and he said, Chris, the management have said, no, it's not going to happen. Chris was extremely upset, and that was a big, big breakdown in there. Relationship. Also, when he went to get married in Las Vegas and disappeared, and they didn't know where he was. This is their breakfast show. The show was sponsored for a lot of money, and there was all sorts of stuff, and the parting of the ways was pretty acrimonious on both sides, from what I gather. Ended up, as we know, in the legal courts. And it was a very sad time. I have got his last running order from his last show that he ever did, with all his scribbling over it. I've got it at home as a little keepsake. And I remember after his last show, he didn't tell me it was his last show. He walked up the corridor at Golden Square, sat in the Zoo Cafe area, and then about 10 minutes later walked down. He looked straight through the glass at me and just waved, and that was him saying goodbye to me. I spent so much time at Virgin, but I spent so much time at Virgin and Absolute because I love Golden Square and they looked after me. And that's the one thing that radio station management have to do across the board is you look after your talent. I'm not talking about wadding up their bank accounts. I'm talking about being human to them, treating them like human beings, encouraging the very best out of them, and not being negative. Or if you bring somebody in and after three books the ratings are going down, just blowing them out of the building. Offer them help. Try everything. If you believe in them to hire them, believe in them to turn it round. That's what I think.
I want to thank you for listening. It has been my privilege and honour to be here talking to you, and I'm really going to miss doing it. What a journey.
Oh, my last show at Golden Square, I kind of knew about it for about 5 months because I'd agreed with Absolute Management, Bauer, because I just said to them, look, I don't think I can actually do anything more for you anymore on this slot. And I think I feel as though I need to move on. I'm not going anywhere. And I wasn't. I just feel that I can stay and do the football on a Saturday, but mid-morning. And they said, no, that's great. We can plan now. And I did my last show. And what happened at the end of it, normally I've got my ear to the ground. I had no idea. I mean, talk about class and giving somebody a send-off and viewed by tens of thousands of people, I think, on Facebook. But the whole staff of the whole building, every radio station that Bauer owned, were either side of the stairs. I mean, it brought a tear to my eye. I mean, I never expected it, and it was such an honour. But I suppose they felt it was an extraordinary achievement in commercial radio. Maybe it was, but the honour to have done it and just been involved and survived was good enough for me. And I went down into the office, and Tony Morey, my boss, and Paul Sylvester made speeches. Steve Parkinson literally had tears in his eye. You know, they were great people to work for. All companies have their faults, but I had a wonderful time working for Virgin and Absolute and Bauer. They are very classy people. I had a couple of months off, and then got a phone call from Michael Cohen did, from Richard Park, who was very quick out of the blocks and said, look, I'd like to talk to you and Russ about coming to Global to do some work. So we went to meet Richard at the Langham, and everything was all hail fellow, well met. And he said, I'd like you to consider coming to Smooth. And I said, but what about sport? So he said, well, you can do the football on LBC. How about that? So I said, well, great. Started on Smooth Breakfast, completely different type of radio it was, but I think the whole idea was I could go in there and not shake it up a bit in a sort of outrageous way, but at least bring it slightly more up to date and modern. That's what I thought. And I did it for 23 months of my contractual 24. The football show Scores, which I'm extremely proud of that show, working for James Rear and Tom and the team at LBC, had a brilliant producer, Ollie Sly, but left Global in back end of February of 2018. And for the armchair programme directors who like to speculate and accumulate rumours, all I can say is that all three of my bosses have invited me out for lunch. One of them, at the time of recording, I'm going to see tomorrow, and the other two are coming up. So they're not the actions of people that hate you. I could sum up my thoughts probably in one shortish couple of sentences, which is, if you set out to sell the juiciest oranges available to people who love juicy oranges, and you're confident yours are the best, tell them where they can buy them off you. I've had a brilliant career. I have no regrets in anything professionally that I've done. The only regret I have is my father phoned me when I got a job at Capital and said, OK, now I accept that decision to leave the bank was probably a good one. Grudgingly, good luck, you know, and all that. Which was quite a manful and nice thing for your dad to say, because I never like to be wrong. My one regret is that my father died 2 weeks before Virgin Radio went on the air. I was doing dry run breakfast shows and going down to Eastbourne, where he was very, very ill. And on the day that he died, I made it with about 5 minutes to go. It was like he hung on for me, but he never got to hear me on Virgin Radio, which was the next step up. And I'm sure he would have been happy if he could have done. So that's the only regret I've got, but that's a normal regret for anyone who's lost a parent.
If you're a fan of the Sex Pistols, we've got a gig to tell you about after 8 o'clock. Exclusive. And we've got free tickets to give away.
I would like to be remembered as a professional, entertaining broadcaster who could do unusually music radio and speech radio to reasonably high levels, with a great passion for this wonderful industry, and somebody who never, ever forgot that all that counts really is the people that listen. Without them, we are all nothing.